We had the thrill and honor to be joined by Don Was and his new band, the Pan Detroit Ensemble. They're playing Blues for Allah. It's a 50th anniversary celebration of the Grateful Dead album. The show is at the Jefferson Theater in Charlottesville. The legendary Don Was, responsible for producing records with the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt, Booker T, Iggy Pop, Willie Nelson, Ringo Starr, Ziggy Marley, and many, many more. A live in-studio soundcheck session with Don Was and the Pan Detroit Ensemble. They're just out with the new record, Groove in the Face of Adversity, on stage at the Jefferson Theater in Charlottesville for WNRN.
Nothing but time. I ain't got. if you took the time to look.
That's Don Was in the Pan Detroit Ensemble. Great warm-up version of the Hank Williams tune, I Ain't Got Nothing But Time. WNRN member soundcheck party at the Jefferson Theater in Charlottesville. Check out the video on this page for the Blues for Allah medley they performed. And now the full interview with Don Was on WNRN.
I'm Jeff Sweatman. Thank you so much for listening to another WNRN in-studio session, this time coming to you from the Jefferson Theater. It's a soundcheck in-studio with Don Was and his amazing new band, the Pan Detroit Ensemble. So we say hello and thank you so much for doing this, Don Was.
Thank
so
you,
good
Jeff.
To meet you.
Thank you all for coming.
Well, for folks that maybe don't know, the new album has just come out, Groove in the Face of Adversity. It's on the Detroit Mac Avenue record label. And as far as the band goes, I wanted to ask how long you've been playing or how long you've known all of these players, how you kind of assembled the band. It's an interesting collection of songs. There's a Hank Williams tune, there's Curtis Mayfield, there's Cameo, Kenny Barron, and then this New Zealand dub band that I was unfamiliar with, frankly, Fat Freddy's yeah. Drop. That's yep. That was Midnight Marauders, the first track that you yep. put out there. And there's one original too. So maybe talk about assembling the band and what kind of songs you wanted to do with this project.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. There's a jazz trumpet player, great movie film composer, and he's written operas that have been performed at the Met, a guy named Terrence Blanchard. And Terrence was like hosting a series. I guess you could say he was curating a series for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra about Detroit jazz. And he called me up 2 years before the date and said, "You want to do one night?" I said, "Yeah, sure, love to, man, thank you." Year and a half goes by, and then 6 months out, I realize I don't have a band, I don't have songs, I don't know what we're doing. So one thing I remembered was that in the 90s, early in the 90s, I had some luck as a producer, and in a very short period of time, like maybe a year, year and a half, I got to work with a bunch of my heroes and people who I think are the greatest writers around, Bob Dylan, Mick and Keith, Leonard Cohen, Willie Nelson, Brian Wilson, Chris Christopherson. And it was a thrill and an honor, but it gave me severe writer's block for about 5 years, because every time I sat down at the piano to play something, I'd think, oh man, what's the fucking point of this? You know, Brian Wilson is a mile away, let's give him the lyric and he'll write something better. So I was just discouraged and blocked. And one day, I was in the studio with Willie Nelson, and I'm looking at him, and again, thinking how shitty I am by comparison to Willie Nelson. I thought, that man, I can never be him. This is frustrating. And then it hit me. But Willie Nelson can't be me. You know, like Willie Nelson didn't drop acid in 1968 and go see the MC5 at the Grandy Ballroom. Willie Nelson didn't have George Clinton play a sock hop at his junior high school with the Parliaments when they were a vocal group. So there's something about growing up in Detroit that made me different from him, made me different from Bob Dylan. So I realized that the only thing, the only real prayer you have as an artist is to be different from everybody else. If you think about it, all the artists that we love and admire, when they came along, there was nobody like them. Who was like Prince? Who was like the Rolling Stones before they were there? Who was like Frank Sinatra? Who's like Neil Young? You know, you can really go down the list. The people who last are the people who were different. So in the music business, executives like myself tend to sign artists that we love and then try to turn them into whatever is popular in the moment. It's the biggest mistake record companies make, I think. The thing that makes you different from everybody else who's out there is not a marketing problem, it's your superpower. So in relation to this gig in Detroit, I thought, well, the only thing we can do here, don't try to be Robert Glasper, don't try to be Yusuf Lateef. Go back to Detroit, hook up with musicians you know who grew up listening to the same radio stations, played in the same bars, played with the same musicians. And so that's what I did. I called people I knew. Some of these guys I've known I played with them for 45 years. The sax player, Dave McMurray, he's played with the Stones and Bob Dylan, and he records for Blue Note. Luis Resto, who's the keyboard player you saw, they were all on the first Was Not Was album and all the tours. But Luis ended up collaborating with Eminem, and he co-wrote and co-produced a lot of stuff, including Lose Yourself. He got up and accepted an Oscar for Best Original Song, and he was wearing a Detroit Pistons jersey under a sports jacket, which nice. No one had ever seen at the Oscars before. So we got together just to see if this could be the band to play for Terrence's thing. And the first thing we played, frankly, I picked four songs that I played on the radio show the night before we had the rehearsal, right? And that was Insane by Cameo, Nubian Lady, the Yusuf Lateef song that's on the album. I played that on the radio show. I played, we're not doing it tonight, but it's a Henry Threadgill song called I Can't Wait Till I Get Home. And they just seemed like there's a lot of range to the style of writing and to the rhythm of it. So we just started playing it, and it became apparent in the first 10 minutes that we all spoke the same musical language and that the level of communication had a real head start. Like, it should take 10 years to be able to play like the way we communicated on the first day. So it became clear that it would be foolish just to play the one show and stop it. So we're now on our fourth tour. We came here from Japan, and first time we played outside the U.S. Album came out last week, and I love this band, man. I'm 73. I'm gonna stick with this band till I drop. I enjoy every single show. I love riding the bus.
Yeah, I saw you announce some more dates for the new year too. Yeah, congrats on all of that.
Yeah, thank you,
just a couple more quick things. I know we got to let you go. First of all, you were mentioning all of those names and unique, just one-of-a-kind type artists. I wanted to get your thoughts on D'Angelo. Did you ever get to meet him or work with him at all?
Never met him. I know a lot of guys who did. Pino Palladino and Chris Dave. I know a lot of guys like Glasper who worshipped him.
And, yeah, we're real proud he's from Richmond around here, down the road.
Right. Now, he was he's incredibly influential. Even in stuff we do, you'll hear things that we play. I'll approach the bass like Pino did when he played on D'Angelo records, just as far as hitting a note and cutting it off real quick and just having it. I can't quite get what he does. Pino's a good friend. I've known him for a long time. And I was just making a record with him in Texas, and I'm sitting right next to him watching his fingers, and I can't figure out what he's doing. He's just connected to some large energy source, but his bass playing is brilliant. But yeah. That's just one example of he approached D'Angelo different from the way he approaches other things.
Right.
I can hear it on what I'm doing, and I ain't got nothing but time, and I'm sure everybody else in the band feels that way.
Yeah. What is it about Blues for Allah? It's the 50th anniversary, of course, but did you, with your relationship with Bob Weir and being in a band with him in the past, did you ask him first before you took it out on the road, or how does that work? What about that album spoke to you for this type of ensemble?
Well, first of all, working with Bobby was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, and I probably wouldn't be able to be in this band if I hadn't done that, because, well, when he called in 2018, and he had played for years with a bass player named Rob Wasserman,
yep,
in a band called Rat Dog, and they actually went around as a duo at first. And I knew Rob. Rob introduced me to Bobby in the 90s. So I knew him a little bit. But he called me up in 2018. He said, I had a dream last night. Wasserman came to me, and he said that the reason he introduced us 20 years ago was that when he was gone, you were supposed to become his replacement. So you want to start a trio with Jay Lane. Like, yeah, of course, man. And so I was excited to do that with him. But the next level of agenda that I had was I wanted to learn how to go out every night without a roadmap and be fearless like he was about it. Because I actually thought it'd be good for music, but I'd like to apply that to every aspect of my life. So I went out there to learn about that. And I think I did, you know. He really is unconcerned if we try something and it's a train wreck. If you've been to our shows, you know what I'm talking about. There'd be a couple times a night where the thing just falls apart. But it falls apart because we're trying to do something that we haven't done before, and we're reaching for something that's kind of like skateboarding or skiing. You try something new, and you fall a couple times, maybe before you get it right. But the audience doesn't mind, because they know they're getting a show that's never been performed before, that we're trying something brand new. So they love it when he forgets the words. They love it when we make a mistake. Because on the other hand, there are moments when we absolutely connect as a band and with the audience. And you can really feel it. It's such a great audience, the Deadheads, man. They're so tuned in a myriad of ways, you know. And, but you can tell that they not only are listening, but they can taste the music, right? And you feel the energy come back, and it makes you choose a different next note, and then you get this circular exchange going. And all together, you can blow the roof off this place, you know, when that connects. And it happens a couple times a night. But the other thing will happen too. And I just learned it's okay. Just go out there and get loose. And for God's sake, don't try to play what you played the night before. That's the only thing you can really do wrong. If it really cooked the night before on some song, don't try that again.
Gotcha.
Because if you try that, everyone else is going to be in a different place. Mm. You start fresh every time. So we did it. The solos you heard tonight, I mean, on this little sound check here, they're not planned out. And we don't really even know what chord it's going to start on. Someone who's feeling loose and edgy and connected to the energy flow will play something, and then everyone responds to it. And and that's the fun part. There's structure, but there's a ton of adventure.
So we had a bit of a technical snafu with the recording at the very beginning, but thankfully we have the audio from the video cameras. Don Was shared some great sentiments about his feelings about public radio. And then I asked him about his approach to DJing his own radio shows. So about a minute of video camera audio, and then back to the rest of our Don Was in studio session at the Jefferson Theater soundcheck party with WNRN members.
Thank you all for coming. And I know you're all members of the station.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I do a radio show on the Detroit NPR station. So I can't tell you how cool it is that you do that, and how essential it is. People are coming after broadcasting, coming hard, and you know, broadcasting is just the tip of the iceberg. Next it'll be music and lyrics and everything. So what you're doing by enabling radio stations to stay independent and to operate with freedom to play whatever they want, whatever it is, you know, that's super important. So thank you all for donating. Being active like that. It's a big deal.
Thank you, guys. Also, thanks to our WNRN members here in attendance. And Don, I I was going to ask you about the radio DJ thing. You've got a couple of different shows going on, right, currently. So how do you choose what you're going to play, first of all? I mean, I assume, maybe not Questlove level, but what's the record collection getting up to at this point? How do you decide what to play?
Well, sometimes I go waltzing through the vinyl. I usually just start what I would play. You know, like riding on the bus every night. Last night we had an 8-hour ride. So we left about 11 o'clock, left Louisville, and got here about 6:30. And I like to stay up, so I'm just hosting a show for myself all night. So basically, start with what I feel like hearing that day.
Same as you, I guess, right?
Yeah.
You kind of go with what you want to hear. And then I do think about transitions. We usually play two songs at a time. Or I host one that's live every Friday night on your sister station, WDET in Detroit.
Right.
And then there's one that's on Sirius XM on John Mayer's channel. He's got his own channel called Life with John Mayer on Sirius. And I host a show that it's called Dinner Party with Don, and it's designed to be stuff that's played in the background at your dinner party, and
gotcha.
It's on at dinner time on Saturday
gotcha.
Night. So that's more like it's thinking about what's going to fit in a little bit and not stop conversation. I don't actually know if anybody listens to it for a dinner party, but that's the theme, and it gives some framework, and then you improvise. It's just like the music, actually, if you think about it. Like any Grateful Dead song, there's a structure to it, and then there are areas where you stretch out. When I'm playing with Weir, like on Franklin's Tower, the way the structure of the song is, you go right into the second verse after the first chorus. But if we're grooving in the chorus, we could stretch that transition into the second verse out for 15 minutes sometimes, and we have. So. You just go kind of with whatever you feel, and you build from there. But doing the radio show is very much like that. Doing the live radio show is really like a performance because you go through the same kind of things where the first 10 minutes, you're running off adrenaline. If you're not a little nervous before a show, there's something wrong. I want to feel butterflies in my stomach. That's part of the fun of it, is getting excited. But then you get too excited. People usually come blasting through the song, and it takes about 10 minutes to settle into a thing. And it's the same with the radio show. Someone points to you, and you're on live, and you got thousands of people listening.
Yeah.
And about 45 minutes into it, I calm down, and I can actually feel everybody out there listening. And it's kind of it's a cool feeling. I learned to do that one year. I was the co-music director with Burt Bacharach. We were co-music directors for the Oscars one year.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about an adrenaline rush. You know it's 80 million people watching
right.
live, and you're playing songs, and if something goes wrong, there's a train wreck. There's no fixing it. The whole world sees it. So everybody, about a week before the show, everybody who's working on the Oscars, they start, the molecules, they start vibrating at a higher speed or something. Everyone is just amped up. And I tried not to get carried away, but you do get swept away by it. But as soon as the show starts, it's a really weird phenomenon. You see the cameras, and you kind of know that the 80 million people are there, but it's like the eye of the hurricane. It's actually really calm, and it's kind of an intimate moment with 80 million people. But I could feel them. And actually, to be honest with you, I kind of hated the Oscars. I thought it was just an outgrowth of gossip culture, and I don't like treating art like it's sports and
right.
giving out awards and keeping standings and all that. I think that's not what it's there for. But as we were doing the thing, I realized that it was really important, the Oscars, not so that a motion picture could have a better, you know, sell more tickets and have a better box score and be number one. But it was important to people. Every one of these movie stars who was sitting in the front row, like Jack Nicholson, he represents like some kind of Jungian archetype. Same, and the people in the front row, they were kind of like the mythological gods on Olympus. But it's like Greek mythology, you know, but in the modern electronic age setting. And it's very important for people to commune with these heroes and to have this ritual. So once the show started, I could feel that. It felt more like church than a sports event, than the Super Bowl. And it was kind of a beautiful experience. I felt connected to 80 million people.
Yeah, that's wild. And not a whole lot of people
and
can
I didn't
say
do
they've
mushrooms
had that experience.
To feel connected.
Well, it's a pretty small theater too, right? Or where they do it now.
The Shrine Auditorium at the time, which is where they used to do the Grammys too, which is really nice. It's very intimate. It felt like the first time I won a Grammy and got up to accept it was for the album Nick of Time with Bonnie Raitt, who won the Grammy for Album of the Year.
Yep.
And I walked on a thing and it reminded me of you got a little armband if you were on the safety patrol in elementary school, and they had a thing, and you know, I was nervous about it, getting up in front of the school, getting my school street crossing armband, right. And the Grammys kind of felt like that, except the front row, I'll never forget it. It was Miles Davis sitting next to Bette Midler, sitting next to Billy Joel. It was like a caricature almost, but it was intimate. It's not as intimate now that I don't love it as much that they do it in arenas. I get it, more people can come and participate, and it makes a lot of money now, but it was really something special when it was small like that. It was, the Oscars were small, and they were in the same room at the Shrine, and I think a lot of the applause and laughing might be dubbed, because everyone is sitting in a room. It really wasn't that much bigger than this. And everybody who's there is terrified because they're up for an award. And that's all they're thinking about is, am I going to win this thing? And if I lose, what do I do? How do I finesse it? It's nerve-wracking. And so it's kind of quiet and tense and intimate.
They might have a laugh track. You're right. Yeah. Well, one last thing. So you mentioned the MC5, getting to see them as a young kid, big influence on you, kind of combining that personal and political. And you got to work with Wayne Kramer last year, right, on an MC5 record?
Wayne played on the first Wasn't a Was record. He was a dear friend for, 35, 40 years.
So the title of this record, I love it, you know, Groove in the Face of Adversity. So how important is that for all of us to kind of groove when faced with adversity?
Well, it's the first step. You know, you may not change everything just by grooving, but if you're not grooving, you're not going to change anything. It's the first step towards action, and also keeps you optimistic. I'll tell you where it comes from. When I was 14, in 1966, I was driving around with my mom. She was making me run errands with her. And man, it was a Saturday. I wanted to be hanging out with my friends. I really didn't want to be doing this. And I was just a grumpy, obnoxious 14-year-old kid, right? She got disgusted with me. She left me in the car. She said, don't come in. Just stay here. Hear the keys. Play with the car radio. So I'm messing with the dial, and I landed on Detroit's jazz station, which I didn't know existed, and I didn't know anything about jazz. I'm sure I absorbed some of it, just peripherally, but I didn't really know. And as I tuned into the station, I heard a song that I later learned was called Mode for Joe, which happens to be on Blue Note Records by a guy named Joe Henderson. And as I came in, it was just the beginning of the sax solo, and he's making these kind of anguished cries from the sax, and I say, da-da-da, da-da-da. And it was startling. I'd never heard that sound before, but it matched my mood. I don't know what he was upset about, but I was upset about being stuck with my mom, right? So I thought, that's exactly how I feel. But, shortly thereafter, the drummer, Joe Chambers, great jazz drummer, still alive, still is the same cymbal, in fact. He starts grooving on that ride cymbal. And Joe Henderson settles into the groove. And I felt like he was talking to me. Like what he was saying was, no matter how anguished you are, you've got to groove in the face of adversity, Don. And he was speaking to me through music that didn't have lyrics. And sure enough, when my mom got back in the car, 5 minutes later, I was a different kid. I was a good kid, and it was not lost on me that music had the power to turn my mood around 180 degrees. It's one of the things that made me want to keep going with music, was to be able to, it seemed like a somewhat noble calling to be able to help people, like make some music that makes people feel better. And the more chaotic and confusing the times are, the more important it is that you have music and art that can do that. That's why they want to throttle art. That's why you got to keep grooving in the face of adversity.
There you go. Very well said. And the one and only Don Was, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Good to see you, man.
Thank you to our WNRN members. And thanks to the Jefferson Theater for their hospitality and for hosting this in-studio session, a soundcheck party at the Jefferson Theater. The show is tonight. Don Was and his brand new band, the Pan Detroit Ensemble, is tonight at the Jefferson Theater as they're playing their own stuff. They're playing stuff off the new album. They're playing Blues for Allah in its entirety. Is that right?
Yeah. Tonight we will. Yeah.
50th anniversary. All the Deadheads unite. Come on out tonight. We'll see you. Thanks, Don.
Thank you all.